Your call has been forwarded to an automatic voice message system. It's not available. At the tone, please record your message. When you have finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
Hi, hey, hello, hi, wow, hi.
Alexis, why are you so excited right now?
A few reasons. One, I just polished off a 6-cup pot of coffee on my own earlier today. Two, due to stay-at-home orders and social distancing to keep folks healthy, I have not been outside in like 64 hours, so I don't have my jiggles out yet. And three, I have a very special voicemail lined up for you today. Way, 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 way back in 2019, which feels like a lifetime ago, I did a series of secret interviews with down-to-earth experts on stuff we need to know, but no one bothered to teach us in school. Stuff like mental health and personal finance and career and nutrition and branding and entrepreneurship and blah, 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 blah. And I distilled that wisdom into a quite useful little podcast package. It's very great and exciting. And that means that I am kicking off a very special series of interview episodes called How to Like Being Alive. Does that name sound familiar? Yeah? Okay, good. You were paying attention last week. The thing that I'm most excited about is that this series of episodes comes with a clubhouse. It's the How to Like Being Alive Club. It is fully loaded, and it is free. Free dollars and 0 cents. So, you know how you hear a fantastic podcast episode or you read a really good article, and then the information just kind of, boop, slips right out of your brain? Not anymore. Now, on top of having experts' answers, you also get their free classes and their worksheets and their book recommendations and workshop tickets and Q&A sessions and roundtable talks. No more boop. Now you actually can have the tools to change your life. That sounds a little dramatic, but I really feel that way. My co-conspirator, Stephanie Gilbert, and I opened this club last week, and it, as I believe the children are saying, is lit. It is poppin'. It's a party. So, How to Like Being Alive is a place to be social off of social media, a space where we can be more and do a little less, because there is a lot of advice on how to be right now during everything going on in the world. And it is a jackpot of free resources. And even though this buzzword makes me want to hurl, it is definitely a budding community. So How to Like Being Alive is like a Facebook group without the algorithm or ads or estranged relatives popping into your newsfeed to make ignorant statements about the world and life. And it's kind of like Twitter, but without hashtags or trolls or hate speech. It's like Instagram, but without the addictive notifications or comparison bait or really, really weirdly accurate sponsored posts, because they're probably listening to your conversation that you had last week. Anyways, it's an online community. And it's not run by a giant corporation using your data to sell you stuff. It's run by two humans, myself and Stephanie Gilbert. And all we want to do is help you figure out how to like being alive. So go on and join the free party and jump into the clubhouse. Introduce yourself and ask questions of your peer experts, or, I don't know, network without getting nauseous, or post photos of your dog, or swap gifts, or make new friends, because How to Like Being Alive is an online social club without the problems of social media. And if you're like, really? Is she serious? Yes. Hit pause right now and type bit.ly/how-to-like-being-alive into your browser and then join our club. You can go do it. It's fine. I'll wait. Okay. Are you back? Did you do it? Okay. Quick reminder, even though this series is called How to Like Being Alive, it's kind of meant to be tongue-in-cheek, because life is way more complicated than a simple how-to guide. We are tired, and we do not need more personal growth homework, and no one has all the answers. But we can learn to ask better questions, and that's what How to Like Being Alive is for. So let's get this special episode/party started. Today's expert human is Miriam Jacobson. Her preferred pronouns are she, her. She's an integrative nutritionist who uses functional medicine to help people resolve underlying reasons for their mystery symptoms, like indigestion, bloating, bowel abnormalities, fatigue, low energy levels, and irritability. If you don't know what integrative nutritionist or functional medicine mean, don't worry, neither did I. We totally cover it in this episode. Miriam believes that nutrition is the foundation for healing the body, and her whole thing is helping people find balance in their bodies and a peaceful relationship with food. I met Miriam at an entrepreneur's retreat that I was leading a workshop in way back in October of 2018. And I think I waited all of like 27 seconds before blurting out a very clunky question about whether our gut health was connected to our mental health, since, and I said this next part proudly, kind of like a little kid announcing a fact they learned at school, most serotonin is produced in our gut. Good one, me. Not awkward at all. Maybe make small talk for like 60 seconds first. It didn't matter. She answered my questions patiently and with a huge smile on her face because she's just that cool. She's also very smart, very dedicated, and very humble. I had to drag it out of her to find out that she has 2 degrees and 3 certifications. She earned her bachelor's in nutrition and dietetics from the University of Wisconsin and her master's of science in human nutrition and functional medicine from the University of Bridgeport. She's a registered dietitian, a certified nutrition specialist, a certified leap therapist. Oh, and a certified yoga instructor too, because the woman is damn dedicated. Even with all of this academic background, Miriam is entirely unpretentious. She has a distinctly millennial way of talking. You know how we love to end all of our sentences with a question? Which makes me feel right at home. Like if I were a 10-year-old kid new to summer camp, she's the chill, kind of like knowledgeable senior in high school camp counselor with all of the answers I need. Was I satisfied after interrogating her at this retreat? Could I leave her alone finally? No. Come on, it's me. When I decided to kick off this How to Like Being Alive series, I immediately emailed her and begged for a remote interview. The best part is that she was just as excited as I was. So across a mostly decent internet connection, we video chatted about alien invaders in our digestive system, probiotics versus prebiotics, accidentally suggestive 90s kids' toys called water snakes, the Dirty Dozen and Clean 15, science's verdict on food trends like cutting calories, juicing, and gluten-free everything, the best diets for people prone to depression or anxiety, are carbs bad? What the fuck is keto? And every rapid-fire question that you guys could think of. So sit back, relax, and get ready to get healthier with MS, RD, CS, integrative nutritionist, and expert human, Miriam Jacobson.
We did not get your message, either because you were not speaking or because of a bad connection. To disconnect, press 1. To record your message, press 2.
Record. Yes, recording. Yeah. Oh, we did it after all that tech shit. Oh. What pays the bills? And what are you passionate about?
Those are great questions. I think I got lucky that part of what I do, I love and it pays the bills. So I help people optimize their health through functional medicine nutrition, through improving their relationship with food, by looking at what's happening in their body from an individualized approach, so that they can thrive in their life, so that they can feel energized and confident and really empowered and engaged around food, rather than kind of just skimming by. I work with clients like one-on-one, and that's really my bread and butter for my business at this point in time. And then what I love is talking with people and helping them feel good in their bodies and about themselves.
That's so awesome. Well, first of all, we need people like you in the world, like helping us figure out how to be healthy and especially just talking us through things. I don't know why, it might just be me personally, but I am often overwhelmed by the health and wellness space and by nutrition.
Yeah. And thank you for saying that, because I think nutrition is like really complicated and really complex. And even being a professional like in this space, I get confused and I do double takes all the time. And I'm like, wait, is that right? And am I just confused? So I appreciate that, because I think that just wellness is saturated and really confusing these days as
it. Yeah. There's so much different advice, so much conflicting advice, so many suggestions, so much of it is built around shaming people. Like I can't wait to dig into your philosophy and what you've learned about nutrition because of the fact that there is so much conflicting information. So How did you get into nutrition? Like, is there a time in your life where something happened or you had an experience that was like, ah, this is what I care about. I want to help people figure out how to be healthy.
Absolutely. So the way that I got started with health and nutrition was kind of by accident. So I went to University of Wisconsin. I was a liberal arts major. I came from a really strong liberal arts background. My high school was all like assessment based and we would have portfolios instead of tests. And so when I got to college, they were like, you know, you need to take a science class. And I was like, what? I need to
take science. What do you mean? Never had to do that before.
And I was like, oh, nutrition sounds kind of interesting. You know, it can be like applied to life. So I guess I'll do that. Yeah. I did terribly in my first nutrition class. I think I was
That makes my heart really happy.
I like took it as a challenge. And after that first class, I couldn't stop thinking about how food interacts with our bodies and just like the multi-level effect that it has on our lives, you know, how it has on our social lives, emotional lives, how we grew up and our cultures are so surrounded by food. And that's really what was like that initial spark that drove me to pursue nutrition and dietetics. And over time it evolved and how I practice has evolved, but that core need to see like how food interacts with your body, I think is so fascinating. After I graduated, I went on the path to become a registered dietitian. I really realized that's not what I wanted to do.
Forgive the stupid question. You're going to get a lot of those today. What is a registered dietitian? Like, what does that job entail? And what was it that helped you realize you didn't want necessarily to have that be your focus?
When I was doing my dietetic residency, which is like your 1,000 hours that you have to do in a hospital to get that supervised training, I was working with this diabetic on bedside nutrition care, and I was like talking to them about healthy living and whole foods. Then the food service staff came in with like some Diet Coke and some whole wheat bread. This isn't helping anyone. This is like barely keeping people alive.
Shots fired at Diet Coke and whole wheat bread. But you know what? They totally have it coming, and you're going to find out later in the episode why. Just hang in there with me.
The reason I wanted to become a nutritionist or dietitian was to help people, to help them feel good, help them thrive in their bodies.
So Miriam tells me that although she had set out to help people experience optimal health as a registered dietitian, her ability to help patients with chronic illnesses was often limited by poor quality hospital food and instructions to only help people manage symptoms of disease rather than use nutrition to treat the root cause of an illness. Which sounds a lot like slapping a Spider-Man themed Band-Aid over a bullet wound and then calling it a day. I would be frustrated too.
Nutrition really affects our mental health on so many levels. So you come to the doctor and you say like, I'm suffering from bloating and constipation and, you know, reflux. They take those symptoms and they say, okay, you have IBS. It's a kind of an excuse to give you certain medications and just a way to put you into different categories rather than in functional medicine and really like holistic integrative medicine, which is what I practice through the lens of nutrition, is looking at why you're experiencing these issues. So instead of being like, okay, you have IBS, I don't really have a solution for you besides like maybe taking a laxative, functional medicine is looking at, okay, like why is there inflammation in the gut? Why is there imbalance there? And what can we do? What proactive solutions can we take to support you towards optimal health?
You know that I am obsessed with helping people understand the hard science of happiness, but in like everyday language, because so much of the research that's been done on happiness is in very academic language. First time we met, I was asking you about gut health. And I was like, okay, I know something about serotonin has to do with brain happiness and then gut health. And somehow gut health is tied to mental health. Can you explain that for like, why?
So the food that we eat affects our gut health, and our gut is connected to our brain. So there's that super highway between our gut and our brain. Okay. Our gut has 500 million neurons.
Wait, what did you say?
Yeah, we have five times more neurons that are in our spinal cord.
Wait, okay, sorry. So I think many people just assume neurons only existed in the brain.
Yeah, so from our esophagus all the way down to like our anus, those are constantly feeding information back from our brain to our gut and vice versa. what we're eating can affect our mental health, right? Because if we're having like digestive upset, that can cause anxiety. If there's inflammation, that can cause like depression for like various reasons. But also the food that we're eating affects the production of neurotransmitters and hormones.
What?
Oh, yes. What do you think neurotransmitters and hormones are made out of? They're made of proteins. Mm. The pathways have nutrients that are cofactors that drive those pathways. And so the food that we eat is like our nutritional status affects our mental health on that end. And most of our brain, 60% of our brain is fat. And so the types of fats that we eat matter too.
So then, okay, this brings me to talking about gut health and our neurotransmitters. What is up with the like gut microflora trend in health and wellness? Like all of a sudden, it's very popular to talk about the bacteria in our guts and keeping them happy. And then I've got questions about probiotics and prebiotics. And what do we need to know about our gut bacteria?
There's a lot of them. There's like tens of trillions of bacteria in our gut. It's like 3 pounds of bacteria.
Oh my God. What?
Like bacteria are so small. There's 3 pounds of bacteria in our gut.
Oh.
So there's a lot of them. There's really good guys. There's bad guys, right? So there's like sometimes a balance, and we want more good guys than bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
And they're influenced by the food that we eat, our stress levels, and like our exposure in our environment.
Hi, future Alexis here.
So these gut microbiota ferment, i.e. break down, the foods your digestive system can't, helping you absorb one final round of nutrients before you visit the facilities. These gut bacteria also communicate with cells in your gut walls called epithelium, helping to improve your immune response and the regulation of your hormones. It's a symbiotic relationship, not unlike the little cleaning fish that follow whales around. You're the landlord and they're the tenants, except these tenants are keeping you healthy.
It's really interesting because when you're born, if you go through like a vaginal birth versus a C-section, you're actually going to have different microflora in your gut. You know, when you go through the birth canal, you're like slathered and your mom's like,
okay, everybody, come outside. Everybody ready for a wild, wet ride?
So you're like getting your mom's bacteria almost.
Oh yeah. And that's like,
and this is good bacteria, right? This is the good stuff.
Yeah, it's even like breastfeeding. Babies pick up their mom's bacteria on their nipples when they breastfeed.
That's amazing.
And that helps to build up their microbiome too. And there's the whole hygiene hypothesis where mm-hmm. if you're playing in dirt, you know, the dirtier you are, like kind of the better your microbiome is.
The hygiene hypothesis argues that the cleaner, more sterile a child's environment is while growing up, the more likely they'll also have autoimmune diseases like allergies or asthma. The general idea here is that kids need to be introduced to germs in order to develop a healthy immune system. This was first introduced in the 1980s by David P. Strachan? I don't know if I'm saying that right. A professor of epidemiology in a paper called Hay Fever, Hygiene, and Household Size. Studies that followed in the 90s confirmed that there's definitely a connection between dirtier environments and higher resistance to disease. But before you lick a toilet seat or sneeze on your friend's kid, E. coli, Salmonella, and other viruses can be very harmful to our immune systems, especially kids' immune systems. So any surface that might have come in contact with poop, raw meat, or sick humans should be cleaned and disinfected thoroughly. You're welcome for that mental image. Overall, there's a lot of evidence that kids sheltered from germs often end up with autoimmune problems. But so far, the evidence is still correlational. There's 100% definitely for sure a connection between oversanitized lives and immune problems, but science hasn't yet proven it's the direct cause. But there's enough evidence that you can stop with the endless use of hand sanitizer, and if you've got kiddos, send them outside to play.
Well, maybe not yet. Keep using hand sanitizer and wash your hands with warm, soapy water. We've been told. And also, don't send your kids outside to play right now. But when everything goes back to normal, we can kind of cool it, I guess. Will things go back to normal? Wow, that's a really scary thought. You know what? Let's just get back to the interview.
People who use antibacterial soaps and stuff, actually, it wears down on their immune system. It wears down on their gut.
Okay. So then how much of the prebiotic, probiotic supplements and or snacks or milks with prebiotic, whatever, all those foods you can buy now, how much of that is a trend and how much of that is actually beneficial? Is it individualized?
So probiotics have a really powerful therapeutic effect on your gut. They basically regulate the environment. If you've like just gone on antibiotics, for example, and you take probiotics, it's kind of good because it helps to reduce the overgrowth of bad guys, but they don't actually regrow bacteria in our gut. That's what prebiotics do. The biggest misconception is that probiotics actually replace the bacteria in your gut. Like if you like take a probiotic, then you're like re-inoculating your gut.
So if, for example, I decide to go, I go to Whole Foods and I buy a bottle of Acidophilus. Mm-hmm. Based on the name, I just assumed that that was a type of bacteria. Am I ingesting that bacteria when I eat that? Or is it food for Acidophilus?
Usually in probiotics, there's like a little bit of both. Like they'll usually have a little bit of like inulin or chicory root, which is a prebiotic. But when you're taking Acidophilus is a type of bacteria, okay, but that specific strain that you're drinking isn't a strain that's in your gut. Oh. The pro like supplements aren't the same as the indigenous populations that we have. So they just regulate the environment.
Okay.
Rather than like actually repopulate.
So they're like, are introduced as managers and they're like, hey, everybody, we're going to keep this place clean. We're going to add some trees.
Let's decide. Maybe there's a happy tree, evergreen tree. He lives right there.
So we're going to add some flowers. Mm-hmm. We're going to keep your neighborhood happy.
Isn't that a nice little tree? We don't make mistakes. We have happy accidents.
But they're not actually the residents of the neighborhood. They're just there to help manage and keep it clean. And
yeah, it's like the fertilizer, like the gardener fertilizer.
So are prebiotics introducing literally in those packages, whole like colonies or low groups of bacteria into our bodies? Is that what
no.
it's doing?
Okay. No, so prebiotics are food for bacteria.
I don't know if you can tell, but at this point in the interview, I'm still very confused on the difference between probiotic and prebiotic. Future Alexis is jumping in here in case you're confused too. Think of our native gut bacteria like a garden. Left on their own, different kinds of plants and flowers and weeds grow at many rates. Some are good, some are bad. Probiotics are like gardeners we introduce to our digestive system to pull weeds, plant seeds, water plants, and trim overgrowth. They keep the garden in check. Prebiotics, on the other hand, are primo fertilizer, aka the types of fiber that feed our gut bacteria and make the garden thrive. Miriam, you sweet, sweet angel. So patient, so helpful. Okay, let's get back to her trying to help me understand basic facts.
When you eat an apple, you're basically eating fiber that your body can't digest some of it. And so it acts as food for bacteria. And then they're like, ooh, we like this food. And then they multiply. So you're not actually eating the bacteria. That's like what the probiotics are. The prebiotics are, it's like the food for the bacteria. And so that's why like the quality of your diet really matters most in terms of supporting.
Because you almost want to be like eating food that makes your bacteria happy, that they can help you break down because they're doing extra work for you that your own digestive system can't do.
Exactly. Probiotics are really good to get like a therapeutic effect, to get regulate that environment. And there's different strains. And so there's like a whole body of research that basically takes different strains of L. rhamnosus 0418, you know, and says what type of therapeutic effect that they have on your body.
Wondering where to get your probios and prebios? I got you. Probiotic foods, or foods that have already been broken down or fermented by friendly bacteria, include kefir, plain yogurt, aged cheese, fermented vegetables, miso, microalgae, pickles, raw honey, sauerkraut, kimchi, kombucha, etc. Prebiotic foods, or foods that your gut tenants will go apeshit for, include chicory root, dandelion greens, Jerusalem artichoke, garlic, onions, leeks, asparagus, bananas, barley, oats, etc. Hi, what the fuck are these foods? I've never heard of them. That's okay. Just buy a probiotic or prebiotic supplement. After asking your doctor and after making sure the company producing them is legit. I'll explain later.
So then the other thing that I've heard a lot about, especially when I went down the like mental health tangent, thinking about serotonin, I learned that tryptophan is the sole precursor to serotonin in our bodies. Meaning, as far as I understand, it's the only thing that can become serotonin in our bodies. When I was talking to you the first time, we were talking about the difference between like where serotonin can travel in your body and do you need a lot in your gut? So could you help me understand, should we all be eating a whole bunch of tryptophan? Is that gonna make us happier? How is it connected to serotonin in our guts?
Really good questions. 90% of the serotonin in our bodies is produced in our gut. Most of people don't realize that serotonin is needed to regulate digestive function.
Explain serotonin, please. Serotonin is a neurotransmitter produced in your brain, gastrointestinal tract, blood platelets, and skin. Serotonin is kind of like the house mom of a sorority. Now, to be fair, I've never been in a sorority, but I think CareerMatch.com describes the job responsibilities of house mom serotonin perfectly. Quote, As a sorority house mom, you oversee the staff, help plan menus, are in charge of food ordering and shopping, and schedule maintenance and repairs for the house. But your main job is being there for the girls in case any issues arise. You have to enjoy, and sometimes tolerate, girls that can be high maintenance or a bit uppity. You may get calls from parents asking you how their daughters are doing or requesting that you check on them. Some girls, or their parents, may expect special treatment, and you sometimes have to serve as a mediator when issues crop up. You have to be a role model, friend, nurse, and teacher to all the girls in the house, just like a mother to her children. It takes a special kind of person to want to be a mother to a large group of female college students all living in the same house. End quote. In other words, serotonin is our emotional checks and balances system. It regulates our sleep, appetites, moods, and more. It deals with our uppity emotional outbursts and generally does the grunt work of keeping us alive by suppressing our drives to overeat, oversleep, and only want to have sex all the time forever. Just like a sorority house mom.
Totally. So that's like what happens when serotonin gets into your brain, right? Across that brain-blood barrier. But serotonin that's produced in your gut is mostly used by the gut, and it's like to regulate your poop cycles, essentially.
Just to keep you balanced. Essentially, it's like a balance chemical, but it, when it's in your guts, it's balancing your digestive system and making sure it's helping you poop normal and all that stuff.
Exactly. And so you're right. Tryptophan is the only way that our bodies make serotonin. Tryptophan is an amino acid, which is a protein in its most primal, like primitive form.
I'm like flashing back to grade school where they're like,
the building blocks of life.
Exactly. There you go. Okay. And so tryptophan is an amino acid. So it's one amino acid of many that's essential. So you need to eat it in order to create serotonin.
Okay. You know how turkey has a reputation for making people sleepy because of something it contains called tryptophan? Well, like most word-of-mouth facts, this one isn't entirely accurate. The sheer volume of food we consume during Thanksgiving turkey dinner is the main reason we get tired, not the tryptophan in turkey. Anyways, tryptophan is an amino acid naturally occurring in many veggies, grains, and meats that we eat. It's also the sole precursor for serotonin in our bodies. We can't make serotonin without tryptophan, and we can't get tryptophan without eating it.
So if you don't have any tryptophan in your body, you can't possibly make body proteins or serotonin.
Okay. So if we eat tryptophan, then it helps produce serotonin. But should we build it into our diet so we have extra floating around in case it can pass the blood-brain barrier into our brains? Or is that like a total myth?
Body has a hierarchy of needs. Tryptophan is not only used to create serotonin, but it has other functions too. Mm. So it creates like body proteins as well. If you're injured, for example, or if you're recovering from working out really hard, right? Those essential proteins are going to be going towards creating muscles rather than creating serotonin. So if it's like needed by other areas in your body, it's going to go to those areas before it goes to serotonin.
So let's break this down. Tryptophan can't cross the blood-brain barrier or the wall that regulates the flow of nutrients in and out of your brain without help. Instead, the tryptophan you eat binds to your blood plasma, and then it fights with other amino acids for a chance to get transported into your brain, where it can become serotonin. A 2016 review-style paper called Influence of Tryptophan and Serotonin on Mood and Cognition with a Possible Role of the Gut-Brain Axis has a detailed list of clinical studies that confirm depletion of tryptophan in the diet rapidly lowers our serotonin, and low serotonin comes with all the adverse side effects you'd expect, like depression, low mood, poor memory, and so on. So while eating foods loaded with tryptophan won't instantly perk you up, tryptophan's availability in your blood will raise your body's serotonin production overall, acting as kind of a buffer against depressive symptoms, potentially also making you happier. Wondering what foods to eat that are naturally high in tryptophan? Of course I have a list. You know I have a list. So this is the top 10, according to the United States Department of Agriculture Research Service, USDA Food Composition Databases. God damn, science research has long titles. Number 1, eggs. Number 2, soy protein or tofu. 3, sesame seeds, including tahini, sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds, seeds in general. Number 4, seaweed and spirulina. Number 5, meat extender, which I had to Google. That is apparently texturized vegetable protein. Number 6, fish. Number 7, cheese and milk. Number 8, game meat. Number 9, beef, lamb, and pork. Number 10, chicken and turkey.
But if you did need like more serotonin in your brain, let's say you're deficient in serotonin, there are supplements that you can take to boost your body's level of serotonin. So as long as you're not on antidepressants, because there's some contraindications for certain supplements.
This is a big, like, everyone ask your doctor.
Ask your doctor.
Ah, the feeling of asking your doctor.
Don't take supplements without asking your doctor first. So there are supplements we can take that will help boost our brain serotonin, assuming that our doctor approves for, like, the kind of life and medications we take.
Yeah, exactly. So 5-HTP is actually one of my favorite supplements to take to boost body's serotonin levels, because it skips that tryptophan step. So it goes from tryptophan, 5-HTP to serotonin. And so if you kind of just, like, bypass this tryptophan one, you kind of bypass the hierarchy of needs.
It jumps into your body already in the format your brain needs. Okay, that's cool.
Cool.
It's really cool.
Oh, cool.
Okay, so then here's the other thing I don't totally understand. A lot of what we're talking about, helping keep our microflora happy and eating, you know, amino acids that are good to regulate and produce serotonin for our guts, it's about reducing inflammation in many ways. Why is inflammation a problem? Because most people think of inflammation as swelling, but why would that be a problem or the cause of diseases? Why do we want to reduce it in our guts?
If there's inflammation for a variety of reasons, if you're not digesting your food well, if you have an overgrowth of bad bacteria, it actually inhibits that step from tryptophan to serotonin.
Oh.
Inflammation, it's a direct inhibition to that tryptophan to serotonin conversion. That's actually a major reason why digestive inflammation is connected to mental health. Mm.
Is there certain things that affects everybody? Like, all of us get inflamed when we eat this or we experience this in our bodies, or is it completely case by case, body to body?
So sometimes it's a case by case, but there are certain foods that are kind of just, like, blanket inflammatory for everyone. So I can tell you what they are.
I feel like that's going to be my next question. Like, what should we not eat that's fucking up our digestive system? Yeah. So what's making everybody inflamed?
Refined sugar. As is, like, fried foods and damaged fats.
What?
God damn it. Okay, so you're saying.
I mean, we knew though, right?
We all knew. It's just, you know, the confirmation is rough. Okay, so when you say damaged fats, what do you mean by damaged fats?
Each type of oil has a certain smoke point. For example, olive oil, most olive oils have a lower smoke point of 300, 350 degrees, unless they're super, super high quality, which is a different conversation. But if they're heated above that, they smoke and they actually damage your cells. And so your cells are made of proteins and fats. That's why trans fats are damaging for your cells, because they're damaged fats and they damage the cell membranes, and that causes cellular inflammation.
Okay, we need to back up and talk about fats. Basically, your body takes the fat you eat and plugs it into the fatty parts of your own cells for stability, healing, and energy. If all you give your body are broken, twisted molecules, then that's all it has to plug into your cells, and that damage wreaks havoc on those cells, adding to inflammation. Damaged fats are fat molecules that have been changed by heat, oxygen, or light. This is why so many oils come in dark glass bottles to prevent light damage to the molecules. So when fats become damaged from overheating, oxygenation, or light spoilage, the byproducts are free radicals and trans fats. Let's just say those are bad for now, okay? The only places that a fat molecule can become damaged is wherever its molecule bends. The more bends that a molecule has in its shape, the easier it can become damaged. Saturated fats look like a straight line. They have no bends, which means that they're hard to damage. These are fats like coconut oil or animal fats. Saturated fatty acids, stuff that has no bends in it, are used by our cells for structure or stability in the body, like maintaining our cell and our lung function. Monounsaturated fats, mono being one, have one bend in the molecule, which make them mostly stable. This is stuff like olive oil or nut oils. Polyunsaturated fats have poly, multiple bends, which means that they're the most prone to damage. This is like flaxseed oil or salmon. But, and this is a gigantic but, just because they're sensitive to damage doesn't make them bad for us. We need all kinds of fats to be healthy. Polyunsaturated fatty acids, for example, fats with many bends in the molecule, are used in the areas of the highest activity in our bodies, like our brain and our eyes. These bendy fats act like a lubricant in our brain, speeding up neurotransmitting activity. Basically, the best place to get your fats from are directly from nature. Seeds, nuts, olives, avocados, seaweed, grains, beans, meat, dairy, coconuts, etc. But yeah, duh. I mean, aren't all fats from nature? Where are we getting the bad broken fats from exactly? I know that's what you're thinking. There's three places, okay? Number one, we're making saturated fat in our livers and way too much of it in an emergency response to sugar and processed foods. It's not that we're eating too much saturated fat, it's that we're making a shit ton of saturated fat. The solution? Eat less sugar and less processed foods. Number two, we're getting them from super processed oils. So like partially hydrogenated oil, trans fats, or oils with super long shelf lives, or really tasteless crystal clear oils. Basically, any fat that we had to do crazy shit to in order to give it a longer shelf life, or be solid at room temperature, or become a preservative in food. The solution is to get your fats naturally in your foods, like eating avocado or chicken, rather than pouring processed oils all over your food, like oily salad dressings or deep frying stuff. And when you buy olive oil, by the way, cloudy is okay, a short shelf life is okay, and expeller pressed is also okay. And the third way we're getting all the bad fats is from cooking with the wrong oils, the kind that damage easily. The solution is don't cook with low smoke point oils, like olive, canola, soy, or safflower. If you need to cook with fats, cook with coconut, lard, or organic butter, and don't let them burn. Damn, that was intense. Too intense to remember, obviously, so I'll link the online sources for all of this information in the How to Like Being Alive Clubhouse.
Okay, so damaged fats and trans fats are bad because they actually, their damaged fat structure wears down and messes up our cell structure.
Yeah, and then our hormones can't bind to our cells, our neurotransmitters can't bind to our cells, so our body can't actually communicate with itself.
Oh my God. Insert the brain, the emoji of the brain. Okay. So you were saying, refined sugar, damaged mm-hmm. fats, and you were also saying...
And my last thing is really poor quality meats. So like meats that are, like I'm a meat eater, and I'm all about high quality proteins, but meats that are like conventional meats that are antibiotics and hormones, that's most of what's in our country, pretty inflammatory, pretty damaging.
And now is this, like, what would make it a poor quality meat? Because I typically we think about, when we talk about high quality meats, we're talking more about the care of the animal in the United States. Like most people are more concerned about the way that animal lived.
The chicken you'll be enjoying tonight.
You have this information. This is fantastic.
Absolutely. His name was Colin.
The kind of state of being that their existence was. Were they in a tiny space or were they free to roam?
Here are his papers, okay?
That's great. He looks like a happy little guy who runs around.
Those kind of things. When you say poor quality, you're talking about the cellular structure of those meats. What do we need to know?
That's a great question. So in the U.S., and I can't speak for other places, it's almost synonymous between the care of the animals and the quality of the meat, almost. Chickens, for example, are meant to be raised on pasture. That's one part of the quality of meat. It's like, what would they normally eat in nature? Okay. And are they eating it now? Their diets affect our diet. They can have just like that conventional corn that's GMO, Monsanto, all American grown, maybe organic corn, but it's still grain. Grains fatten animals up and make them more inflamed, right? So we give them grains and then they like grow fatten up because that's what we want in our food industry, right? Is like bigger animals. And then the antibiotic and hormone thing is when you like give cows, for example, antibiotics, it actually changes their gut flora, makes them more inflamed. And so they've done studies where they take grass-fed cows and conventionally raised cows that are fat corn-based cows.
Yeah.
And you can see the fat content is actually different.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's great. So if I understand this correctly, when you say the quality of the meat, we're talking about the way that they were raised, not just the space that they were in, but what they were eating. If they're eating something that isn't what they would naturally eat, if we're giving them corn versus grass, then their own gut systems are getting inflamed. And they're actually getting fatter because that's what we want. We want fatter meats. We want juicier meats. But that is also bad for us because then we're sort of eating their inflammation. Is that kind of like a generic?
That's essentially it.
So the nutrients we're getting from conventionally raised animals that eat foods that are not natural to their evolved environments. When we eat those conventional animals, we are eating protein and fats that have a totally different, like a different effect on our bodies than if we ate like a grass-fed, pasture-raised, happy little animal. So it's not just about their mood when they were living. It's also about like the kind of meat they became. That's affecting the way we digest.
Yeah. So like as much as I care about animal welfare as well, it really is like the health of our bodies too, that it makes a giant impact on. And so like the studies have shown that grass-fed meats actually have higher amounts of antioxidants in them and higher amounts of those omega-3 fats, which are so important for our brain health. Omega-3 fats are basically anti-inflammatory fats versus okay. omega-6 fats, which are a little more inflammatory, and like saturated fats, which are even more inflammatory.
Quick reminder, we need omega-6, omega-3, and saturated fats to function. The problem is that our ratios, especially in America, are way off. Grains and processed foods with grains have way more omega-6 fats, while naturally occurring fats and animal proteins have more omega-3. Because we're eating so much processed food, grains, and conventional animal meat, fed grains instead of grass, we're inheriting way more omega-6 than we actually need. Here's the kicker, okay? Our bodies need omega-6 to produce inflammation, to protect us, like swelling from injury or healing our muscles. But too much of that omega-6 and not enough omega-3, which reduces inflammation, equals very inflamed bodies. That's why we need more omega-3 in our diets. And that's why pasture-raised, grass-fed meat and poultry is so crucial. We need to stop inheriting inflammation from the meats and grains we're eating. Yeah? Cool.
Well, okay. So then let's put a hypothetical out there for people listening. If we're meat eaters.
Just give me all the bacon and eggs you have.
We love eating meat. We're omnivores. We're never going to go vegan or totally vegetarian.
Wait. I worry what you just heard was give me a lot of bacon and eggs. What I said was give me all the bacon and eggs you have.
And we don't have a huge amount of money to spend. What is a better choice for our budgets and our bodies to spend money on meat that is raised healthy, grass-fed, pasture-raised, organic, etc., or maybe middle of the road meat and organic vegetables? Because I'm on a budget and it costs a lot to buy grass-fed bison from Whole Foods.
Totally. No, and I totally appreciate that. I'm going to maybe take more of a middle ground answer.
Yeah.
And say, look at the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15 for organic produce if you're really on a budget.
The Environmental Working Group, a nonprofit environmental watchdog, releases its shopper guide to pesticides and produce every year. And this is 2019's list. The Dirty Dozen are the top 12 fruits and veggies with the highest levels of dangerous pesticide residue. Ready? Strawberries, spinach, kale, nectarines, apples, grapes, peaches, cherries, pears, tomatoes, celery, potatoes. Buy these things organic whenever your wallet permits it. The Clean 15 are vegetables and fruits that have the lowest levels of dangerous pesticide residue. So if you have to buy conventional, not organic, then these are the safest for you. Number one, avocados. Yes. What? Yes, avocados. Two, sweet corn, pineapples, frozen sweet peas, onions, papayas, eggplants, asparagus, kiwis, cabbages, cauliflower, cantaloupe, broccoli, mushrooms, honeydew melons. By the way, quote, when organic versions are unavailable or not affordable, EWG advises consumers to continue eating fresh produce, even if conventionally grown. The health benefits of a diet rich in fruits and vegetables outweigh the risks of pesticide exposure. That's from the EWG's website and their lists. And yeah, I know you already forgot everything I listed. Don't worry about it. Links and the lists will also be in the How to Like Being Alive Clubhouse, just waiting for you to take to the grocery store with you.
In terms of picking the quality of meat, yeah, pick organic versus over conventional. If you can buy pasture-raised, but yeah, buying like $9 dozen eggs isn't always realistic.
Okay, so in the world of spending money on better quality foods, if we can't afford the most high quality organic and pasture-raised things, then the next best choice would be at least organic things. And then the next best choice would be when it comes to vegetables, the Dirty Dozen Clean 15 list. Every little bit of effort to make an educated, healthy food decision count. So if you can't afford it all, it's okay. It doesn't mean just like you're screwing yourself over. It's just one healthy choice every day makes a bigger difference in your body and reducing inflammation than not doing anything.
Yeah, and it's what you're doing most of the time. I think so often we get caught up with needing to be perfect. We don't need to be perfect, you know? I love sugar. I eat sugar. You know, I'm a dietitian. I think that we just need to like our best shot and be aware of those choices that we are making.
Okay. So I feel like we have a better grasp on inflammation and on the right foods to eat. If we can cut back on something, it sounds like it's sugar.
I love you, but this is my tough love moment. Packaged foods are more processed, they're more refined, and they're not as close to the way that they grew out of the earth. And so I really try to encourage people to eat food in their whole form as much as they can.
So if you were describing, again, to a 10-year-old, asking for a friend, if you were describing that concept of like, don't eat processed foods to a 10-year-old, what is bad about processing a food? Or why is eating a fresh piece of fruit better for us than eating a fruit cup? What is it about processing that is so unhealthy? I mean, I can see already the fruit cup has sugar in it. So like it's added something.
Yeah. Well, the fibers are going to be more broken down. It's going to be simpler sugar. So it's going to kind of send your blood sugar on a little bit of a roller coaster there. And the processing itself strips nutrients too. As an example, you know what quinoa looks like, right?
Yeah. It's like the little circular brown seed, yellowy seed that sometimes has a little curly Q.
Little curly Q when it gets all like puffed up.
Like a little piggy tail.
So we have quinoa, right? But then we also have, like, I don't know if you've ever seen quinoa flakes, but it looks like oatmeal. And then there's quinoa flour and like quinoa pasta.
Yeah.
Each thing is a different level of processing. And so there's going to be a lot more nutrients in the whole quinoa than when it's like ground and rolled out and made into a pasta.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we're talking about the more stuff you do to the food, the less nutrients it naturally has. So you're working harder to digest something and getting less from it.
Yeah. And sometimes your body actually needs extra nutrients to process it.
Are carbs bad for us? Why does everyone hate carbs?
Carbs have gotten such a bad rap, and I just them a little bit.
Why does everyone hate them? Like, what is so bad about carbs, and what do they mean? I'm assuming when I hear carbs are bad, that people are talking about very processed foods, like a whole bunch of pasta versus eating a less processed grain. But in general, why do carbs have a bad rap, and what love do you want to give them?
Carbs usually have a bad rap because they're so addictive, and so like we can't really control ourselves a lot of the time around them. So carbs stimulate the release of dopamine in our brain, which is that like pleasure neurotransmitter. It makes us like happy and motivated to keep eating more. Yeah, it releases endorphins. It like makes you feel good, you know, but there's like that double-edged sword where the carbs also promote fat gain. And we live in a really fat phobic society. I think really that's where like a lot of these fears and phobias stem from, is like there was a lot of transition and food fears from like the 80s when we were fat free because it was funded by the sugar industry, and now we're scared of sugar.
So it's all a little twisty no matter what decade you're living in. So then what about the carbs and vegetables? I'm supposed to eat vegetables, right?
Yeah, absolutely. When it comes to carbs, having them in their whole grain forms is best. Brown rice and quinoa and buckwheat and amaranth. But then there's also carbs in certain plant-based foods. We have potatoes, we have squash, we have beets and carrots. And there's even carbs in like non-starchy vegetables. Let's see, beans, lentils, hummus. Really good sources of carbs too. Okay. And we need carbs. They fuel us. They fuel our bodies and our brains. Okay. And so having them in balance is good. But I think like the whole refining and marketing process is really what has gotten us a little bit.
This is going to probably annoy you because you're an expert and because this is such a complicated, beautifully interwoven topic. But I'm that person who's going to ask you to boil down. If you had only three pieces of nutrition advice to promote our mental health or our happiness or well-being through nutrition, what would those three pieces of advice be?
The first thing is to focus on how you feel rather than how you look. So like how food is making your body feel and fuel yourself, and how it makes you feel like happy and confident and energized, rather than feeling like you need to fit into like a certain piece of clothing that you have or reach a certain number on the scale. Number two would be focus on what you're including in your diet rather than what you're excluding. Because when we are like, I'm totally going to quit sugar today. I'm going to do it. Today's the day. All your brain is hearing is sugar, 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 sugar. That makes it so challenging. And you're just fighting this uphill battle rather than I'm going to fill my plate up with colorful foods and things that really make me happy and feel good. It really changes the conversation in a really, really big way. Number three would be connect with what drives you to make certain food-related decisions. I find that when we're connected with what is causing us to crave certain foods and make certain food choices, whether that's because you're stressed or because that's just what you've been doing for 15 years and that's what you're used to, you know, versus because you really feel imbalanced and you can't control your appetite around food, whatever it is, when you understand what's driving those choices, you become a lot more empowered by food.
So it's kind of asking, why am I craving this? Why am I choosing this? It's sort of being more self-aware around food so you can make the choices you want to make as opposed to just sort of doing whatever you do, living by habit.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think doing that honestly makes people feel more empowered because if they want a piece of chocolate, they can sit down and enjoy the chocolate without having the guilt associated with it.
Chocolate.
That's pretty damn good for forcing you to choose three things.
Thanks.
Okay. So do you have time for rapid fire questions or do you want to do them another day? Okay.
Yeah, let's do
it. I love how many questions I got from the audience. Like I asked everybody on Instagram to tell me what they wanted to know. And oh boy, did they have a lot. So let me get my list out here.
Yeah.
I have two for you first because I'm selfish. But do you have any myths about nutrition that you want to bust? Like just a whole bunch of bullshit or flim flam that you're like, get out of here. This is trash. Any myths?
Yeah. Oh my God. Where to start? We already covered why carbs are bad.
Yeah.
All carbs are not bad.
FYI, everybody.
Got it.
Carb up.
So, okay. Juice cleanses aren't a detox.
I'm on my weekly world news Garth Brooks juice diet.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I love
and gluten-free
hearing that.
Everything isn't like healthier. Like that you're gluten-free doesn't give you a health stamp.
It's okay. It's gluten-free.
Right away, right? What you're eating still matters.
I love it. You just validated all of my internal monologue around these food trends. I love it. Okay, so then are there any food or drink trends that are super dangerous? Give us a couple examples.
Yeah, so I've been seeing, just things that I've been seeing lately are people cutting calories to dangerously low levels, like people coming in to see me and being like, I'm having 1,100 calories a day. That's actually not healthy.
Okay.
We need to eat food to fuel our bodies. And then I also have been seeing a lot of keto around.
Yeah, what the fuck is keto? Talk to me about keto because this is one of these new trends where, you know, healthy fats and extreme amounts of protein. And I'm like, wait a second. The idea of putting the body into ketosis, literally going into shock in order to process a type of thing is scary to me. So can you summarize that in some way?
Yeah, absolutely. So basically the keto diet is a diet that's mostly fat. You're basically reducing most of your carbs. I think it's like, I forget the percentage. I think it's like 5 or 10% carbs.
It's extreme. I remember whatever documentary I saw was
25 grams of carbs a day. It's like ridiculously low. And it basically switches your metabolism so that your body's burning fat and overdrive and your brain is running on ketones rather than sugar.
But wait. Isn't sugar bad for us? Yes. When Miriam says sugar here, she means naturally occurring glucose, the source of most energy in the body, not sweet and low.
Wow. So that's dangerous because it's throwing off the body's natural rhythm?
So the thing is, it's dangerous because we don't know what it does long term. It's dangerous for your gut because carbohydrates feed your gut bacteria, which we've been talking about like all morning. The quality of your diet really does matter. If you don't have any vegetables, which the keto diet cuts out a lot of vegetables because they're high in carbohydrates. Mm-hmm. You're actually starving those and you don't know the effects of the keto diet long-term. It was originally created for people with epilepsy.
So I had to do some digging on ketosis to better understand it. It's essentially a state of cellular starvation where the body becomes desperate for energy because there's no glucose left to convert. So it breaks down fat from the liver in order to survive. I also looked into the study she mentioned, and she's right. Everything I could find that said keto was beneficial were clinical trials using ketosis to help people with brain disorders like Alzheimer's, autism, Parkinson's, and others. Keto was very promising in helping reduce symptoms of untreatable neurological disorders and for short periods of time, possibly because of the effect these ketones had on the negative brain symptoms, but not for general populations, and not for long-term use. So flipping your metabolism upside down is extremely taxing on the liver and totally untested on brains that don't have severe neurological conditions. So maybe cool it on putting lard in your coffee, okay? Oh, and if you think you could benefit from keto, ask your doctor. I bet you won't. Ask them anyways.
And now people are kind of like loading up on bacon and saturated fats and cheese, you know, and the quality of the diet really isn't high and it's not meant to be followed long term. A month or 2 months, like fine, but longer than that, it's really dangerous.
Yeah, and it's sort of being marketed as a lifestyle choice, which is even more dangerous to me because I think people are even more wary of diets now and sort of talking about this lifestyle choice of keto or the lifestyle choice of paleo. I am glad to hear that there's not yet evidence that this is not extremely harmful long term. And just in general, what it does to your metabolism is really risky because I was very suspicious.
My last harmful diet is the carnivore diet.
So just straight up eating meat, like all meat all the time? Is this like the Atkins diet from the 90s or whatever?
I feel like the carnivore diet, the keto diet is kind of like versions of the Atkins diet.
Yeah. It's like the millennial version.
Essentially, yeah. Rebranded.
Okay. All right, everybody. Don't go down a weird diet path. Everyone, just be cool. Provide your body with fresh, healthy ingredients.
It's so funny. It's like balanced isn't super sexy to sell. So.
I know. It's like me talking about mental health. Everything, every piece of advice I've ever been shared with people that are science-based, everyone's like, yeah, that sounds pretty standard. I'm like, well, you're not drinking water. So maybe drink water. I don't know. Just like you'll feel better. Okay. I'm going to go through a couple more user questions. At Linden Co. Social wants to know, do you have any advice on how to overcome food addiction or binge eating?
My short answer is understand why you're craving those foods. Usually with food addiction and binge eating, it's a function of something else going on in your life, and we use food to numb that pain.
Would you recommend people, if they feel like they truly are dealing with food addiction or binging, that they should work with a professional if they can, or...
Yeah, if they can, and if that's in their budget or wheelhouse, absolutely. If you can't, I have a few books that I can also recommend. So the first one is The End of Overeating. It's a great book that kind of goes through the neuropsychology of food addiction.
Okay.
And why we make certain choices that we make and how to break that cycle. Awesome. And then the other one that I really love is called Eating in the Light of the Moon. And that talks about more of the emotional side. And so she ties in a lot of folklore. It's written by an eating disorder psychiatrist. And so those two books I think are really powerful. I also have a cravings crash course. So I can give you the link to.
Oh, great. Yes, please. Course. Yeah.
That really teaches people like why they crave foods. And that can be really powerful too.
See, Linden Co. Social, we're hooking you up. That's great. Okay. So I have a question from Stokes R. Is there an ideal diet, not to lose weight, but just a regular meal routine?
My short answer is yes, there's an ideal diet. My like mealtime checklist when I'm sitting down for lunch and dinner.
Hi, future Alexis again. Yes, I will link her mealtime checklist in the How to Like Being Live Clubhouse.
If I have a high quality protein, a veggie, some sort of high quality carb, maybe not, and a good fat, those are kind of my little checklists.
Okay. So. What about, is there a good diet for someone who's prone to depression?
I love the Mediterranean diet. I think that's a really good diet because the paleo diet cuts out carbs. We need carbs, obviously, to shuttle tryptophan, make serotonin in our brains.
Yes.
I like the Mediterranean diet. There's lots of good fats on there too.
Okay.
This diet consists of fish, monounsaturated fats from olive oil, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and moderate alcohol consumption. The Mediterranean diet has been shown to reduce the burden or even prevent the development of cardiovascular disease, breast cancer, depression, colorectal cancer, diabetes, obesity, asthma, erectile dysfunction, and cognitive decline. Damn. By the way, did you catch that? I said it quickly, but monounsaturated fats, the one-bend fats that are naturally occurring in nature, those are the good ones for this diet. Oh, and in a 2017 paper published in Nutritional Neuroscience called Dietary Recommendations for the Prevention of Depression, it says, 1. Follow traditional dietary patterns such as the Mediterranean, Norwegian, or Japanese diet. 2. Increase consumption of fruits, vegetables, legumes, whole grain cereals, nuts, and seeds. 3. Include a high consumption of foods rich in omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids. 4. Replace unhealthy foods with wholesome nutrition foods. 5. Limit your intake of processed foods, fast foods, commercial bakery goods, and sweets. And finally, in a 2014 paper called The Effect of Dietary Tryptophan on Affective Disorders, there's a quote that says, "The results of our study indicated that increasing dietary intake of tryptophan may affect depression and mood scores of healthy participants, resulting in less depressive symptoms and better mood states when more tryptophan was present in their diet." All of that science to say, Mediterranean diet, diet with tryptophan, whole foods, less fatty, fast foods, commercial bakery goods, sweets, that's how you eat if you're prone to depression.
That was the real BLT, by the way. I didn't get to say their name. And then at Dorna Molini wants to know, are eggs good or is all cholesterol still considered bad?
Cholesterol doesn't raise your cholesterol. The eggs come back to the quality of the eggs. Half pasture raised eggs. Make sure you're also eating the yolk because the yolk has the most of the nutrients and the protein.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. At her first 100K wants to know, I want all of the sweet things all of the time, other than the obvious, like, you know, eat fruit. Ugh. What is the least harmful type? What is the least harmful type of chocolate, sugar / dessert that I can have that's still satisfying?
Great question. In order for those foods to be satisfying, you need to understand why you're craving them. Because if you want them, enjoy them, they'll be satisfying. If you're driving your choices from somewhere else, understand that and deal with those issues. So that's like my little nutritionist spiel before I actually answer. Play around with flavors. You might be surprised at what you can create with fruits. So for example, one of my favorite things is to make popsicles and doing mint and lemon and watermelon. Blend that up and freeze them. And they're really, that really hits my sweet spot. Other ideas would be taking coconut milk and cacao powder with like a date even and blending it in a high-speed blender, putting it in your fridge and it turns into a decadent pudding.
That sounds amazing. I did something like that with frozen bananas and then cacao powder and oat milk. And I blended that and it tasted like I was having a chocolate milkshake. It had some banana vibes to it. But it was still very creamy, which was kind of cool. I don't know if her first 100K likes bananas, but I also like that.
You could do, have you ever done the banana whip? Like with the frozen banana. I love putting cacao nibs in there too because it makes it feel like chocolate chip.
That sounds amazing. Okay, now I'm hungry.
right? If you want to do 70% chocolate or like coconut sugar, like a little bit, I rather you have than like the artificial crap.
At Stokes R also asked, is there a food or diet or supplement that helps increase memory?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole family of supplements that help to improve memory and mental health. Usually I'll do those testing where I individualize it, but just kind of across the board, B vitamins are probably one of the first things that I'd recommend for mental health because our B vitamins are needed by every pathway in our brain and yes, it's like energy producing pathway in our bodies. But then there's also herbs like ginseng, ginkgo, and like lion's mane mushroom. So there's lots of different functional herbs.
Okay, cool. This is a question from M of the AM. Supplements, it's like you have to be an alchemist to understand the how/why/when. I'm totally with her on this. And I also have to add to her question, how do we know that the supplement being sold to us is legitimately helpful? Is there a way to know that this supplement is helpful and not just like a snake oil salesman kind of thing?
So there's a lot of difference in the quality of supplements and a lot of different supplements out there. Yeah. So the first thing that I'm looking for is the quality. So I look for the brand name and I look to see, okay, do they do their own testing? Do they do their third-party testing? And is what they claim in their supplement actually what's in their supplement?
When you're looking at your supplements to figure out if they're legit, look for a USP or consumer lab label. These are two independent nonprofit organizations that test for purity, quality, and quantity of the ingredients in that supplement. And yes, links to what these labels look like so you actually know when you're in the store will be in the clubhouse.
You know, we shouldn't take supplements willy-nilly because they can do more harm than they can do, you know, good sometimes. And the quality of the supplement matters. And so I usually make supplement programs for people rather than telling them to piece together their own. Because like you said, there's so many out there. You need to know what you're doing.
Ask your doctor. Ask your doctor. Ask your doctor. Ask your doctor.
So M of the AM, do your research. And if that overwhelms you, then possibly work with Miriam.
Talk to me.
She knows what's up. Okay, so at Rini by Design asked about gut health, which we've talked about at length. But she wants to know about its effect on the skin.
Yes. So fun fact that will blow your mind. The very inside of your gut, it's like your gut's a tube, right? From your mouth, your anus. The very, very inside of your gut's actually the outside of your skin. So they're developed the same in embryo.
That is amazing and crazy. Oh my God. I'm like an inside out. You know those toys from the 90s that were like slippery?
It should be noted that Miriam is laughing hysterically right now because she's watching me try to describe those clear glitter and gel-filled slippery tube toys from the 90s called water snakes, which inevitably looks like I'm making a very lewd motion with my hands. So sorry, experts of the world. Apparently I can't keep a Zoom interview PG.
Oh my God.
Exactly. That's what I need to demonstrate.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, if you have irritation in your gut, you're going to show it on skin.
So maybe having some issues with your skin, a sign that there might be some imbalances in your gut.
It's usually one of the first things that will show up.
So in addition to this list of rapid fire questions, even after I closed the question poll, a billion more questions came flooding in for Miriam, and when I told her about that, she was the coolest and offered to answer them after the fact. So here's a couple more that she really wanted to answer for you. First, from @SmithGrams, how do you establish a healthy baseline for your body type? Everyone seems to have certain types of metabolisms, and as someone with a high metabolism, it seems most of food/meal planning is centered around weight loss, which is not what my body type needs.
I think this is such a good point because even people who don't want to lose weight, who are looking to maintain their weight, it's still important to eat a well-balanced diet because food equals our vitality. Calling in high-quality unprocessed foods is really important and is the forefront. Like my mealtime checklist, I always like to make sure there's veggies and protein, a little bit of fat, and some complex carbohydrates on my plate. And so someone who has a higher metabolism, who does not necessarily need to lose weight, those are people who can either have bigger portion sizes or have more complex carbohydrates in their diet. And I don't mean to like plug my program at all, but that's actually a reason that I created the Food Foundations program, is to help people clarify like what foods are good for them and to help them intuitively connect with what foods make them feel satisfied and to guide them to that place where then they can decide for themselves.
This one's from @ToTheWindowsToTheWalls. Foods to avoid for people with anxiety. Her favorite recipe? Yes, I love how passionate Miriam is about this. She answered the last batch of questions early one morning after we had already finished our interview. You can tell by her morning voice. I love it.
The thing to keep in mind for people with anxiety is their body's blood sugar levels. Of course, digestive issues like we were talking about because the gut's the second nervous system, but blood sugar is really like the number one thing in terms of like your daily intake that I like to keep in mind. So the things to look for are foods that are really high in simple sugars and that are like only made of carbohydrates. If you're having those alone, that's going to send your body's blood sugar to go really high, and then it's going to dip. And on the dips is when you start feeling low energy, anxious, and that anxiety can sometimes, you know, be masked more by low blood sugar. And then my favorite recipe, I think that I like to switch up my foods. I like to eat seasonally. And my most favorite seasonal recipe that I've been on right now is a peach and green salad. I actually have the recipe on my website, but it's like peaches, tomatoes, a bunch of herbs, snap peas, just all thrown into a bowl. And then you can pair that with like avocado or tempeh or chicken if you eat meat. Super easy. It takes about 10 minutes to make.
Then @BrendaMangalore asked, am I fucking up my kid if I give her ice cream? Basically, how often can I give treats?
You're not fucking up your kid if you give her ice cream. I think that there's something important to be said about helping kids have a positive relationship with food, and a lot that comes with that is not restricting their intake. It's almost just as harmful if you're like, no, you can never have ice cream. Ice cream's bad. Because like, what kind of message is that sending to your child about food in terms of that longevity of that relationship? Ice cream is definitely like a treat, but I don't know if it should like ever be put on a pedestal. So maybe like once a week, twice a week, but I don't think that there is anything wrong with giving your child ice cream.
Financials for Creative said, you've got to ask something poop related. That's the most magical thing/result, with crying emojis, laughing, and also love her.
And yeah, everything really comes back to poop and digestion, because there is so much that happens on our gut, and understanding your digestive health, understanding your bowel movements, is really the key for like unlocking your whole body's health. And so if you actually want to know more about like what your poop is actually saying, I also have a blog post. So Alexis, I'll also send that to you as well.
Adriana Webster wanted to know if there were additional resources to read. So if listeners have more questions or they want to know where they can get more nutrition advice, do you want to point them anywhere? Is there some resources you have?
Yeah, I have resources that I can offer you guys from my own practice. And then like I also have some books that I love that I can share with you. One of my favorite nutrition books is The Omnivore's Dilemma. Michael Pollan, I think, is just mind-blowing. And if you haven't read it, the insights into the food system have shifted my perspective in what I look for. And then have you read A Mind of Your Own? That's on my reading list. Oh, yeah. It's all about depression and really getting back your own like mental health on your own.
Oh, it's on my list now too. Thank you.
And then I mentioned a few more earlier on the call. Yes.
Is there anywhere else you want to direct listeners? Where do you want people to find you on the internet? How can they get in touch with you?
So people can find me on my website. That's everybodybliss.com. Okay. And I also am pretty active on Instagram, which is my handle at everybodybliss. And I have some gut health cheat sheets and starter worksheets and craving crash courses. And I'll give you all the links to those so you can share them with people.
Yes. Nobody knows it yet, but they just hit the jackpot of nutritional resources and practical expertise. I love it so much. It makes me really, really happy. Thank you forever times infinity for answering all my stupid questions. It means the world to me. I really, really, really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Alexis.
Is your brain exploding? Mine too. Have you already forgotten the titles of the book she recommended, what was on the Dirty Dozen and Clean 15 list, and every other amazing thing you just learned? That's okay. We planned for this. Go to www.bit.ly/how-to-like-being-alive. Join our Slack group and then check out the stupid number of epic resources that go along with this episode. In addition to all of the science, links, and recommendations that Miriam mentioned, she's also shared a free mini course, a gut health guide, worksheets, and more. P.S. You should know that I enrolled in Miriam's Food Foundations online course, and I really like it. It's great. It's helpful nutrition information that doesn't make me feel shitty about myself, and that's important. And also, I like that I can move through it at my own pace. I can come back to the information whenever I'm ready. And because I'm spending so much time at home during shelter in place, this is a really good time for me to learn more through online courses. So anyways, if you're tired of mystery symptoms and you liked Miriam's vibe, then you should definitely check out her course. I'll drop the Food Foundations link, the special unique link that I have, in the show notes for you. And last piece of good news, I will be hosting a free live online nutrition and gut health Q&A with Miriam herself next week in our How to Like Being Alive Slack group. So that's next Friday. Oh, did you hear my stomach growl? Oh my God, I'm so hungry. So that's next Friday, April 3rd at 2 p.m. PST Pacific or 5 p.m. Eastern. 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern, Friday, April 3rd. You're invited. Free Q&A online with Miriam. All you have to do is join our Slack group. Like I said, that's www.bit.ly/how-to-like-being-alive. Jump in our personal health section. It's a little channel that you can jump into. Get your invite and save your seat and ask her all of your questions. And if you can't make it, don't worry. All of our club members will get a free replay because you might not be able to make it. Who knows? Any hoozles. If you like this episode, even the tiniest little bit, please leave a review. It's the only way to tell the podcast hosts like iTunes and Spotify that my little podcast baby is worth ranking. So help me help other humans figure out how to like being alive. Yeah? Yeah? Thank you. Please and thank you. Okay, wow. You are the best. Hashtag bless your answering machine. I don't know how it's not broken yet. This is a very long episode. I love you. Call me when you get this. Okay, bye.